You're listening to a podcast from Blogging Heads TV.
Hello, Bill.
Good morning, Matt.
It is morning still, technically.
Yeah, we almost did a rare nightcap version of the DMZ because you had a tough schedule this week, but you managed to work in a normal morning time where you're at your A game is on.
And well, I don't know about that. I don't know when the last time my A game was on. It's been a while, but the goal in life is to be so good that even your B game is still other people's A game.
Well, this is a tough week for our usual glib and emotionally soulless political chat, being that it's the week after the worst mass shooting in modern American history. It's a relatively confusing mass shooting because usually 3 days after the fact, we'd have a much clearer sense of what the motive was. There'd be some kind of, explanation left by the shooter or the shooter was actually, didn't commit suicide. And here we're really kind of, groping to figure out what happened here. But we are having, I think, our very predictable cycle of debate over guns, with folks on the left pushing background checks and assault weapons ban, folks on the right saying, you can't legislate away evil, with the one wrinkle that there is some inkling of interest on the Republican side to ban bump stocks, which have now become more common knowledge, that an accessory to a semi-automatic rifle that can make it function more like an automatic rifle. And automatic rifles are actually banned. So as the argument goes, if automatic rifles are banned, have been banned for years, not even the NRA is saying we should legalize automatic rifles. Why should we legalize an accessory that allows a weapon to function like one? I don't know where you are in that, Matt. Is this something where you could actually find a smidgen of common ground? Or should we expect the NRA to swoop in soon enough saying, whoa, wait a second here. You start banning this one thing, then they're going to start banning this thing and that thing. And there's actually good reasons to have bump stocks. There's plenty of legitimate reasons to have a bump stock. And you're going to let those good salts of the earth not to have their bump stocks? That's crazy.
Well, I can't think of a good reason to have a bump stock. Maybe someone can tell me if there is one. The slippery slope argument's the only legitimate one. I do think slippery slopes are a problem. Some people think that it's like a canard. But no, I think this is actually an area where we could have some accomplishment. I don't know if you saw James Homan over at the Washington Post does a weekly email. And yesterday, I guess that was Wednesday, he featured a presentation that Bruce Melman put together, who's a Republican lobbyist, brother of Ken Melman. And in this presentation, one of the slides, it's very interesting, but one of the slides showed that the most popular thing Donald Trump has done this entire, since he's been elected, is cut the deal with Chuck and Nancy. And by far the most popular thing, according to this presentation. And so I think that there is a hunger, a clamoring for people to work together and to get things done. And I do think this one's different, partly for the reasons that you described, Bill. First of all, machine guns are already illegal. And so this product, I think, sort of fits into that rubric. That hasn't been the case with other examples of gun control. Also, this is like the rare occasion when gun control, if we're talking about getting rid of the bump stock, where that would have actually potentially made a difference, right? So like this shooter in Vegas, I think he passed background checks.
Yep.
I think the things that he bought legally. A lot of the sort of usual things that gun control advocates bring up usually wouldn't have helped. So in the wake of a shooting, they usually want to do something, and it wouldn't have mattered. You know, we could have done that, but it wouldn't have stuck. This is an occasion where, had he not had the bump stock, it's very possible that he would not have been able to kill as many people as he did. He still would have been able to do a lot, but it would have saved some lives.
But you have just made an argument that is the exact same argument for an assault weapons ban.
Not exactly. Well, part of the problem with the assault weapons ban is that assault weapons are categorized essentially as guns that look scary. And so there are other guns that are, you know, perfectly legal that would not be banned, exactly the same, well, except for
there were flaws in the assault weapons ban that was in place from 94 to 2004 because the way the language was, certain guns that would still be considered semi-automatics were still legal. Those are problems you could solve with more delicately crafted legislative language. The basic argument has been and still is, these are a class of guns that you do not need for sport, you do not need for hunting, you do not need for self-defense. They are designed to kill large numbers of people in a short period of time. Therefore, they should be banned. I mean, that is analogous to the bump stock argument.
It's analogous to my second bump stock argument. But the first argument I made was that this is essentially converting a, and I'm not a gun guy, but this is, essentially converting a semi-automatic into an automatic, and that using it is actually illegal. Automatic machine guns are illegal, and that is why I think, that this is unique. And I think that there is an opportunity. Obviously, we have Republicans who are coming out in support of this, or at least expressing openness to this. And I think that it would be very shrewd, put aside the right and the wrong. I mean, I just think it would be politically sagacious for Donald Trump to embrace this.
Now, the NRA is like literally the outside group that spent the most amount of money on the Trump campaign.
Well, we don't know yet where they're. We assume that they'll be against this as a slippery slope argument. But there have been times in the past where they have come out in favor of some modest gun control. And for the reasons I just described, it's possible. Maybe I'll look stupid for even suggesting this possibility. We don't know where they're going to come down on this.
I would think the more likely outcome here is Republicans in more vulnerable areas express their openness to a bump stock ban, and there's a fair amount of chatter for a few days, few weeks, and then, like every other mass shooting, other news fills the void.
Yeah.
Our memories fade, and then lo and behold, Ryan McConnell, oh, I just didn't get around to putting that on the floor for a vote. I am so sorry we didn't get to that.
Totally possible, but I would say this feels different to me because I don't see this thing leading to a slippery slope the way that I think that other gun control could. It's like a different category because it's like an aftermarket product that most of us didn't even know about. And that effectively does something that is already illegal. So it seems like it is a technicality. And so I don't have the same reservations about this leading to more gun control and to confiscation or registration or all the things that really worry Second Amendment advocates. I don't have those concerns about this. And again, I mean, if you're Donald Trump and you're looking at the poll, now I know the NRA stuck with him through thick and thin, that they donated a lot of money to him. But if you're looking at the poll numbers and you want popularity, you want adoration, this would be very popular for Donald Trump, and he would be historic. This is a president who'd probably getting things done that Barack Obama didn't get done.
Well, of course, the poll numbers for universal background checks were through the roof, or are still through the roof. They're 90%, and the NRA didn't flinch at those things, and they redoubled their efforts and made their case to their people that this was a slippery slope situation, or the way this was crafted was going to be too expansive. they found so whatever niggling detail they wanted to focus on, whatever, and however disingenuous it was, they still put that out there, and Republicans blocked it and did not suffer at the polls.
It may very well be that the NRA is so much smarter than all these other groups. They stuck with Trump through thick and thin. They didn't waver. They didn't abandon him. Maybe they forged personal relationships with him that will transcend the desire for popularity and, frankly, for probably doing just what is simply right. But Donald Trump is also a guy who in the past has been for gun control. This is a guy who's from New York City. It's a guy who theoretically, presumably loves wants to be popular. And he's already decided that Mitch McConnell and Paul Ryan are not, I'm not saying he's throwing them under the bus completely, but he's not going to stake his legacy, his reputation, his administration on them. So I think there's more possibility that this happened. I think maybe I'm more optimistic than you are on this one.
Well, let's take the optimistic view and that this has a good shot. A bump stock ban would not have affected any other public mass shooting or any other form of gun violence that has occurred over the past, in our lifetimes. This is a very, very, very narrow prescription to deal with a single, although...
To deal with the biggest mass shooting in history, though,
it's
right?
It's the biggest mass shooting in history, but as of today, it's 58 fatalities. I don't want to treat any individual life in a trivial way, but we have about 34,000 gun deaths every year.
Most of them are probably suicides, though, aren't they?
Two-thirds are suicides, which does not make them any less significant. In fact, there's an important point to be made there. Most gun deaths are suicides. Most gun deaths and most homicides are from handguns and not assault weapons or rifles. So you got, even within the category of homicides, it's 67% are handguns, and it's 3% that are rifles of any sort. This brings us to a point that I wrote about for Politico this week. Who on the left will lead on gun control? Our public focus on gun violence pretty much only happens for public mass shootings, of which there are since 2012. We've had between 4 to 7 public mass shootings of 4 or more fatalities per year, which is more than what we had between 2000 and 2012, when the range was between 0 and 4 per year. So there's a feeling that there's this huge rise in gun violence because we've had this somewhat minor increase in public mass shootings, which in and of themselves is an extremely small amount of what the gun epidemic is in the country, which is largely suicide, largely handgun. But because we only talk about the issue when there's a public mass shooting, the prescriptions that are offered are inherently very narrow. Let's tighten the background check system. Let's have an assault. Assault weapons ban is considered like the boldest proposal out there, which would only deal with less than 3% of the gun deaths that happen every year. So a bump stock ban, you're talking, a narrow solution upon narrow solution.
Right, but the only way to stop the gun suicide problem, which amounts to about 2/3 of the fatalities, would be to basically ban all guns and confiscate all guns.
If not an outright ban, this is a very key point. Once you start talking about what the actual source of the gun problem is, the logical step to take is how do you curtail access to handguns? If you're going to propose a ban, you have to propose a constitutional amendment, because the current Supreme Court has interpreted the Second Amendment to say you have an individual right to own a gun. We're going to strike down the handgun bans that were in place at the municipal level in D.C. and Chicago. Now, there are Democrats out there that propose constitutional amendments to overturn Citizens United, so it's not like no one's ever thought of a constitutional amendment before. On the conservative side, people talk about constitutional amendments to ban abortions. So people have taken that step in the public discourse before, and we just saw in the past 24 hours, Michael Moore has raised that point, and yeah. Conservative Bret Stephens has made that
point.
Wow,
this gets so, this gets so messy, and I have to tell you, apparently, Peggy Noonan, I didn't see this, but I saw it on Twitter or something. Peggy Noonan was talking yesterday on TV, probably MSNBC, about so obviously another way of addressing the suicide issue would be dealing with mental health, right? We haven't gotten into that. I don't mean for that to be like a red herring or a diversion, but that's a topic. But what Peggy Noonan was talking about was people feel very insecure right now in America. And they want to be able to protect their families. And I'll just give you, this will sound like crazy and like conspiratorial, but let me just give you like one example of what I think a lot of ordinary Americans out there are thinking about. Recently it was reported that North Korea was planning, or maybe there were concerns, I forget the details, but an electronic pulse attack. Do you know about this,
yeah,
Bill, or even
yeah.
with the electronic pulse?
Yeah,
it would essentially...
Gingrich has been on this thing for a long time.
Yeah, Gingrich and Santorum and others have been concerned about this. Effectively, like an electronic pulse attack would basically take us back to the Stone Ages, except we're not prepared for that. You know, the people back then were used to it. Like, you know, theoretically, a car made after like 1975 won't start. Computers don't, electronic money disappears, you can't get to it. Refrigeration doesn't work. So basically you would have people who don't have food and water. It would essentially be like Puerto Rico, except nobody's coming to help you, right?
So if I had my handgun, I would be able to deal with this this dystopian environment in a way that
you would be better prepared to deal with it. What if you're stockpiling food and water?
Well, but this is an important point. So I want to get to the self-defense point, but let me just do it a little circuitously. So obviously, a constitutional amendment's not going to happen anytime soon, if ever.
Unless Bret Stephens has his way.
Right. So short of a ban, you could have stronger licensing. You could have nationwide licensing for all guns. You could have requirements to get that license, like you do for driving. You have to pass a safety course. So there are, and in Connecticut, and there, I think there are a number of states that have licensing programs, but I know in Connecticut they've had one since '95. There's research that says they cut their gun homicides down by 40%. After having this program. So Senator Chris Murphy, who's probably the loudest voice for gun control in the Senate, you know, has a bill that doesn't mandate every state have that licensing program, but creates a financial incentive. It gives grant money from the Justice Department for other states who set up programs like that. Now, so he's on the record for that. And he had an op-ed in the Washington Post this week where he was saying we should take on the NRA, we should propose these various things, and we should not be afraid of that organization. The polls are on our side. Let's be bold. But the bill that he's working on to introduce in the aftermath of Vegas is another background check bill, which is, you know, the lowest of the lower hanging fruit after, you know, bump stocks. And even that, you know, Obama couldn't get that passed with a Democratic Senate. After Sandy Hook, when people thought, gee, that's Sandy Hook, how could people not pass a gun control measure after Sandy Hook? Well, they still couldn't. It was five votes short, and four Democrats bolted on that as well at the time. So you have a situation on the left where people are naturally inclined to mostly propose incremental solutions because there still is a fear. An understandable fear. I mean, I don't want to sound dismissive of the politics here, there is a lot of evidence that having a robust gun control agenda will not help Democrats win in the states that they need to win back to win in 2020. I mean, Hillary Clinton ran on the most overt gun control agenda of any Democrat since Al Gore in 2000, and she lost. Barack Obama downplayed gun control in 2008 and 2012, and there were candidates in 2006 that had pro-gun rhetoric that helped take back the Congress in that election. So I get why Democrats in general don't want to take those bold risks. Having said that, and this is the point of the Politico piece, you have Bernie Sanders saying, let's propose Medicare for all, even though it's not going to pass, because we need to change the conversation. We need to think long term. We need to build a movement to do these things. We need to inspire people on our side of the fence. As of this moment, I mean, you know, Murphy is sort of dancing around it, but no one has really gone out there after this and said, this is the expansive agenda that we should be rallying around, even though it can't pass today. There's an opening for somebody, if someone wants to make a name for themselves before 2020, to say, I am the person who's going to champion this comprehensive package that's going to deal with the real source of the problem, which is handguns, and related to that, suicides, because a potential suicide victim is more likely to, quote-unquote, succeed with killing themselves if they have access to a handgun as opposed to using pills or hanging themselves or what have you. No one has done that yet, and I'm not convinced anyone is going to do that. But maybe because Stevens is out there, Michael Moore is out there, people might start talking about, hey, wait a second, what is the actual problem here? And even I know you're a Second Amendment guy, and you're not going to want to go down that path. But I think regardless of where you sit, there is value in understanding what the problem actually is.
Well, I do think it's a losing. I mean, segue right and wrong. I do think it's a losing political argument. I think there's probably plenty of people who are like liberal in so many ways, pro-gay marriage, pro-choice, you go down the list, but they want to be able to protect themselves in their home.
Oh, yeah, I know people like that. I mean, I live near Vermont. Yeah. I mean, Vermont has a very deeply entrenched pro-gun culture, even though they're probably the most liberal state in the union. It's a mostly white rural state. There's a sense that I need to protect myself. I should have the freedom to do what I want with myself and my property. I mean, so there is I had previously thought that as hunting declined in American society, that people's affinity for guns would decline along with it. But what has happened is there has been a very abrupt shift in the primary reason why people buy guns from hunting to self-defense. And that has been promoted. If you watch a lot of NRA videos, there is a lot of evidence of danger is all around you. You need to protect yourself. It's your freedom to protect yourself. You can't trust the government to, you know, stop the Islamic threat or what have you.
Yeah. And I think there's probably more women than we might realize who are, you know, maybe they don't have the NRA sticker on their car, but you know, you talk to them, they're packing heat.
Oh, and there are women gun groups out there trying to, you know, Dana Loesch is one of the main spokespeople for that effort. So I get the cultural difficulty. I mean, I don't think you're going to persuade someone who is currently very gun loyal to flip because that sense of individual freedom is really ingrained at this point, and that fear of is ingrained.
And here's why I think so I would say two things. One, instead of like worrying about what's not getting done, I would just celebrate. I think this bump stock thing is a chance where we could actually do something. It would have helped. Amazingly, it would have helped. It almost never happens that it would have helped in the wake of something. So it would have helped this case. And maybe I'm wrong, but I think Americans are prepared. I think most Americans are okay with the suicide thing. Number one, you're hurting yourself. Number two, maybe a gun expedites it, but there's plenty of ways if you want to kill yourself that you can do it. I'm not saying this is true or false, right or wrong. I'm saying I think most Americans that the suicide thing would not be a compelling reason for them to be against the Second Amendment. I think they would say, like, they're doing it to themselves. They're not hurting someone else. I even think the crime is not the compelling reason. I think people just assume that there are certain risks in life. You could get hit by a car, you know, God forbid, don't want it to happen. But I'm just saying in terms of public perception. But I don't think we want somebody to be able to go up in a tall building with essentially what is effectively an automatic weapon and mow down 58 people in 5 or 10 minutes. I don't think we can accept that. So not only do I think it's the case you never let a crisis go to waste, right? That there's a reason why gun rights activists or gun control activists are using this moment. I think it actually makes sense logically too. It's not just never let a crisis go to waste.
Well, you know me. I am fundamentally a pragmatist. I'm all for getting past what you can get past. I'm not saying that people should not push a bump stock bill just because it would only deal with a small part of the problem. If you can get it passed, great. You should pass it. I wrote a piece back in the Sandy Hook time when Obama was getting pushed back because he wasn't necessarily prioritizing the assault weapons ban, and people thought that was showing timidity on his part. I said, look, there's, as you were saying, there's no evidence that the assault weapons ban is even the end-all be-all of this issue. We don't really know exactly which of these various small bore measures might have the most impact. You should try to get past whatever you can get past and see what works. So I'm not trying to argue that people should there should be a bold-only strategy and zero pragmatism strategy. What I am saying is right now we have a incremental-only strategy.
Right.
And because of that, I think that is very susceptible to disingenuous attack on the right, because you – maybe it's not going with bump stocks, but you talk about the background checks. People say, well, background checks wouldn't have stopped Stephen Paddock, so that's not the end-all be-all. Well, we should have assault weapons ban. Oh, well, you know that that's not going to change what's happening on the streets of Chicago. You don't even seem to care about that. Every time you post it's incremental without having that broader critique behind you, you're vulnerable to being called out for not fully solving the problem. And the people who are calling you out on that are people who have zero interest in more expansive legislation to call the problem, but they know you are too afraid to take the bait and argue for the more comprehensive solution because that's more politically dangerous. So it's I think it's a bit of a catch-22 situation. And so not that the party should do this, but some individuals should do this, take that political risk. So
well, somebody
that's
did
part of the
this.
Conversation.
Somebody did do this, and supposedly conservative columnist, the New York Times. Am I right? Is he supposed to be a conservative columnist?
Right, so he was hired.
Brett Stevens.
So he was hired as a new conservative columnist, a way to expand the range of voices on the page.
Third anti-Trump conservative voice.
Right.
Although good luck finding a pro-conservative columnist who's any good. But
because
anyway.
They already have David Brooks, I believe Peter Wenner, or is it Weber?
Wainer.
He's there periodically. He's critical of Trump on the right.
Douthat,
right?
Amazing takedown of Hugh Hefner, the obituary. Did you read that, Bill?
Well, I did read that, and I thought it was. I didn't agree with every single line, but I thought it was a strong piece, and I saw Jonah Goldberg tweeted out saying, you know, the left, you know, isn't able to write this. And I was like, and a lot of people were like, are you reading the left lately? There's a whole bunch of stuff on the left criticizing you, Hefner, today.
I was actually, there's a young lady, and Nomiki, do you know who I'm talking about? She's like a Bernie Sanders.
Yeah, Nomiki Const.
And she wrote she either wrote or tweeted something that was like a feminist takedown of Hef that impressed me.
There are a lot of feminist takedowns of Hef in Jessica Valenti wrote one for Marie
that might
Claire.
Have maybe that was no that wasn't what it was right. But yeah, good for them, good on them for for being consistent.
So that distraction aside, when Stevens was hired, the left was up in arms because he has been skeptical of climate science, and so there was a push to boycott the Times and cancel subscriptions. You know, we shouldn't have any climate science deniers on the op-ed page. And I doubt that the people actually did cancel subscriptions. And look, I am virulently disgusted by climate science denial, just like many other liberals. But you can't blame an entire newspaper. This is the newspaper that's probably doing some of the best journalism in the country. This is an outlet that Trump and many of the conservatives would love to see be decimated. You can't excoriate the entire publication because they have one guy on who's going to say something that you don't like.
I think the New York Times does great stuff. Sometimes I think they're biased, but...
Well, and from a climate perspective, they have one of the most robust environmental desks in the business. You can't walk away from reading the New York Times cover to cover and say, I don't think global warming is real. That's not possible. So to nitpick Stevens on that point struck me as disproportionate. And if you did actually not hire him, you wouldn't get stuff like what you got today, which was a conservative argument for the Second Amendment.
It was not a conservative argument. It wasn't. Definitionally wrong. It was ostensibly a conservative who was arguing for repealing the Second Amendment.
So you cannot be a conservative and believe that guns should be regulated?
I don't think you can be a conservative and argue for repealing the Second Amendment.
I mean, a conservative can be for proposing a anti-abortion amendment, right?
Could you be for repealing?
Is the Constitution so sacrosanct that it's anti-conservative to propose any changes to it? Because if that was the case, you can't be for an anti-abortion amendment.
I do think it's hard to be a conservative and repeal the Bill of Rights. I would think that would be hard. To be a conservative and to be for repeal, you can amend the Constitution, but to repeal something from the Bill of Rights and be a conservative, I'm not saying it's impossible, but that would be a stretch, I think.
Well, I don't think the Constitution should be treated as inherently sacred just by its mere existence. In it, things can be sacred because of their value. You know, the 14th Amendment is sacred because of its value, but. I mean, the Second Amendment, I think wherever you stand on the gun issue, the Second Amendment is a poorly worded amendment by the mere fact that nobody can agree on what it actually means.
It is interesting. I will say it is interesting, and maybe some of this is, just because of the language has changed and the way that people write and speak has changed. But it is interesting that the founders, who were obviously, brilliant men, wrote... Not just that. I mean, there are things that are very open to interpretation. I think, frankly, I think it unfortunately opened the door for revisionists to change their intent, the founder's intent. But you're right. I think it is interesting that things are vaguely worded or worded ambiguously in this case, I would say. Is it about a well-regulated militia?
Right.
Or is it about the right of Americans that the government will not infringe on the right of Americans?
Right.
So, anyway.
So I think that we value whatever the country wants to do to say, let's just clarify this amendment so we all agree what this is supposed to mean for modern times.
That might have been an interesting column, but that's also not exactly what he said. I'm pretty astounded that he wrote. That he wrote this column, and there's a line. Maybe it's from Napoleon. I don't know, but it's something like that. Courage is the most important virtue because it guarantees the survival of all the other virtues. Something like that. I'm sure I'm butchering this quote, but I think you could argue the Second Amendment is the most important of all the amendments because it guarantees like the others. I mean, if you have, and I know there's. Questions about what the second is this for hunt? Are guns just for hunting?
Right.
Are guns just for a militia? But if you buy into the argument that part of the reason that there's a Second Amendment is to keep government in check and to defend liberty and freedom, as I think a lot of conservatives do, how do you defend the First Amendment if there's here's the other point, right? Other people, I think Jonah Goldberg made this point. How can you be for like banning guns if you simultaneously believe Donald Trump is a fascist authoritarian, right? Like, isn't one an argument against the other?
Well, I mean, this is
from Donald Trump's fascist regime.
But this is the conservative libertarian interpretation of the Second Amendment. Our freedoms are secured by the fact that we can arm ourselves and the government can't come in and steamroll us because they'll get shot. I mean, that's...
If I were an authoritarian regime, the first thing I would do is make sure people don't have guns.
Right. I mean, that is the conservative interpretation of the amendment. The liberal interpretation is this is strictly about well-regulated militia. This is a time where there was no standing army. This was how the country defended itself at that time, by citizens having guns that could be called up in times of crisis. And therefore, you don't want to infringe that right. But now we don't even have regulated militias anymore. Therefore, that makes the amendment, you know, non-operative. But so that's just two different, complete different worldviews about what is involved in securing our basic rights, which is why you are never going to repeal the amendment. You're never going to come to consensus on it, and it's going to be an issue that divides us, you know, forever.
But I'm stunned that somebody who calls themselves a conservative columnist, and Bill, you know, I've been called a rhino, a conservative, you could go down the list, right? I'm somewhat contrarian, and I don't always toe the party line, the movement line, all that stuff. And even I am saying, how can this guy ostensibly represent the conservative cause when he's writing this column?
Well, you know, I think being named a New York Times columnist is akin to being named to the Supreme Court. Once you get there, you're free. You're free. No one's got anything over you. You can say whatever you want. I mean, it's like quite having lifetime tenure. But, you know, people don't get fired from the New York Times columnist page very often. They tend to be there for a long time.
This is why we should end tenure at the New York Times. Every year you should be up for a, you know, re-election or something.
And so Stevens is free. Stevens does not have to immediately go to the knee-jerk place. Well, I guess I have to be at pro-Second Amendment because conservatives expect me to. He can let his mind roam and see where it takes him. And this is why it doesn't make a lot of sense to deny people a job offer like that because of their past record. It's also why it doesn't make – and look, I'm totally for blocking conservatives in the Supreme Court in many respects. But it is instructive that there are plenty of cases of people who you would not have thought would do – non-conservative things based on their record, get there and do non-conservative things, because that was the point of making an institution removed from electoral politics, giving them lifetime tenure so they could make decisions that were not tied to special interest electoral pressure. And that has worked over
yeah,
200
except,
years.
Yeah, except that it only works one way. The liberal special interests never lose anybody. Well, the liberals always vote in lockstep.
Facts,
and trust me,
facts and logic are separate things.
But they don't have a monopoly on virtue. Sometimes they're wrong and they have special interests. And they vote in lockstep.
That's
the Republican.
That's not fair. There are plenty of issues where Ginsburg and Breyer do not vote lockstep on the left. There are, you know, 8-1, 9-0 decisions that liberals do not like. I mean, the reason why Ginsburg is there, I know we're getting way off additional topic, but the reason why Ginsburg is there is because Orrin Hatch recommended her, in part because she had a very idiosyncratic view of Roe v. Wade and thought it was poorly reasoned. That was an indication of her intellectual independence. That's why she's there.
The producer said, Bob Wright's talking to my ear. All right. We'll move on. Okay.
I don't know what else there is to talk about this week. do you have anything to say about so getting off of the gun issue? You know, Trump went to Puerto Rico, did his usual spectacle there. We had this flap with Rex Tillerson. It turns out that he once called Trump a moron, which he refuses to deny.
Nothing moron, apparently. Isn't that funny? That was the one time where the story wasn't enough. That he had called him a moron. Like, it was even more scandalous than that.
Well, let's focus on the terrorist thing. So I want to make two related points here. So one, this comes out a few days after Trump seemingly humiliates Tillerson by saying, you're on the record saying you want to talk to North Korea and that you have back channels going. Don't waste your time, Rex. Yeah, that never works. And you then had Mattis make a comment publicly, I think it was in congressional testimony, that we should stay in the Iran nuclear deal. And then a political story came out after that saying that the going thinking in the White House is that Trump will decertify the deal when the deadline happens. I think it's next week or soon thereafter, but will not press Congress to follow up and take and reimpose sanctions, effectively leaving the deal in place. So symbolically dissing it, but not actually theoretically undermining it. So there's all this weird stuff happening in the foreign policy space where there's a lot of bluster, but potentially not a lot of follow through. You know, here's Trump admonishing Tillerson, but he's not dropping a bomb in North Korea. Treasury Department's pursuing sanctions policy, which is what everyone does with North Korea. Tillerson, as far as I know, hasn't stopped his back channels with North Korea. So is this a lot of, you know, sort of amateurish good cop, bad cop? Or is it less well thought out? And, you know, it's sort of a side point. You hear a lot of, you know, Tillerson's pathetic that he's standing for this. He should resign. Just like Jeff Sessions should stand for his tongue lashing. He should resign. But who's the weak one here? Trump's the one who can't fire these people. Trump. There was another story that came out that Tillerson, Mattis, and Mnuchin have some sort of suicide pact that if one goes, they'll all go. I mean, that's like a near mutiny. That's a Trump's not running the show here. These people are doing their own policy.
Well, where did that story?
That was in BuzzFeed, from? I believe. I don't know how well sourced it is, but that was in BuzzFeed.
Wow. So is that recent?
Yeah, that came out this week. But whether that's true or not, there clearly is evidence that Trump is not dictating to his cabinet members what they do in their day-to-day jobs. Who's the weak one in that situation? I'd argue Trump's the weak one. He's not the one actually dictating policy.
Yeah. I don't know if he's not dictating policy. He's certainly not dictating their day-to-day activity. But
I mean, Trump could swoop in and negate their work, but the tweets do not negate their work by themselves.
Right.
It is very possible Tillerson is going to work out some kind of stand down with North Korea. I mean, look, Jeff Sessions got this Rush investigation out of the gate, even though Trump didn't want it to. And Trump's still steaming about it. I mean, if Trump was strong, he'd shut it down. He doesn't, because he doesn't have the strength to do it.
Well, luckily we have a system that makes it very difficult one person to...
Well, that's right. But because of that system, Trump is not as omnipotent a president as I'm sure he would like to be.
Yeah, which is good. End it there.
So, do you think it's so? Having said it, but do you possibly that the other side is true that Trump is making it impossible for the government to function because he's undermining his officials every chance he gets?
I don't know. Maybe it's like the naive optimist. I hold out hope that something good or okay will come out of all of this, you know, like chaos. You know, that like despite Trump, something good will come out. You know, we won't be blown up by North Korea. Maybe he'll freak them out.
You know, I don't believe in my. This is just a gut feeling. This is not. You know, it's not based on zero evidence, but it's you can't know exactly what's going on in Trump's head, you know, on a minute-to-minute basis. I just don't believe he has the stomach to start his own war. I mean, obviously, he's inherited stuff. You know, he's inherited counterterrorism operations from past administrations. And there's all these things happening in, you know, Afghanistan and Libya and stuff that was existing. But to own your own war is a whole other enterprise. And I just don't think he wants it. I don't think he would believe that's fun. I don't think he wants to have the optic of him going playing golf every weekend while he's launching a war. I don't think it's good for his lifestyle to start a war. I think he likes talking about it. I think it's fun to sound like a tough guy. And I think his fans are bowled over by the rhetoric. And are satisfied with that without the follow through of actual carnage. You know, it may be there's some design to try to provoke Iran to start something, I'll decertify it myself and I'll fall through the sanctions and see what they do in response. Maybe there's some mischievous logic there. When you have your defense secretary telling Iran, hey, I know you're sticking to the deal and I want you to stay in it, and you're not admonished by the president in doing that, that says to me deep down, you don't want to have a war.
That's an interesting point. I hadn't really thoroughly considered that, but it makes sense. Like, how is this going to affect his day-to-day life? Like, is this going to be a drag? Like, is he going to have to do stuff he doesn't want to do and, like, focus his time? Like, yeah, it would be a pain, right? Who needs that?
I never really bought the logic that presidents start wars for crass political gain. Just by definition, you don't know where a war is going to go. A war is no guaranteed political winner. There's obviously the initial bump in the polls you might get when it starts, but things can very easily go awry. I mean, not that I think that every president starts a war for defensible reasons. But I've never really bought the argument that you do it for crass political reasons when there's many other ways to get your polls up besides starting a war. And I think there's many other ways for
bump stock.
And I just don't think it's why Trump got into this business. I think this is on some level fun for him to be the center of attention. And it's a fairly dreary existence to be a war president. So why do it?
Yeah, in this day and age, I mean, I know like in the past there was like a sort of a glory to war and stuff, but like in this day and age with the media, even if like you quote unquote win a war, like I just don't see how you come out of it looking good, you know? So,
and there's obviously a lot of talk that Trump will be the worst president of all time, which I'm not necessarily saying will end up being the case, but it's going to be hard to beat the debacle that was the Iraq War. I mean, as awful as Trump has been, you don't have that kind of body count on his watch yet. You know, he's an embarrassment. He's a humiliation. He may weaken the international world order, which may well be more important over the long haul than the tragic body count of a single war. But you do at least have an argument at this point that as bad as he is, there's not a lot of dead people on his watch yet.
And I mean, you know, I think you can make a good argument from a conservative perspective that, like, you know, just World War One was a good argument for appeasement. You know, mm-hmm. If you're England, do you want to go to war again mm-hmm. over what, the Sudetenland? Mm-hmm. It's their land. Let them. You know, we just had World War One. That sucked. Well, we also don't want to do that again, right?
And also, Great Britain was not very well armed at that point, too. They were not in a great position to launch a war.
Well, my point is that, you know, sort of wars chasing, you know, people, even if you win them as they did. And so, like, there's, like, the Vietnamese syndrome. I think if it wasn't for Iraq, maybe we would have taken care of North Korea or Iran, right?
Well, I think both those cases, I mean North Korea especially, I mean, you launch war with North Korea, boom, there goes Seoul. I mean, there's inherent problems with war with North Korea.
Sure. Is it less likely today that we're going to stop North Korea from going nuclear because we went into Iraq? I think so. We still got that hanging over our head. The memories are fresh of
I don't know about that. I mean, we did Libya, you know, we bombed plenty in the Middle East to deal with ISIS. I don't know if you'd have a logical sense that I don't know if America has the guts to pull the trigger anymore. I mean, clearly, even if one president is less reluctant because they're Democrats, the next Republican might be right around the corner. So, I don't think you can always bank on America not being willing to drop a bomb. There's plenty of evidence that they'll get to it if they want to. But I think North Korea knows where they're geographically situated makes that move intrinsically difficult, and they have exploited that all the way through for the past 20 years.
All right. Another award-winning show.
Always good to talk to you, Mr. Lewis. Where can people find your work?
Daily Beast. And CNN and Matt Lewis and the News podcast.
All right. And our podcast, This Is Not Normal, at liberalvoices.com, still kicking. And find my work over at Politico. We'll catch you next week. Well, you know what? I'm going to be in D.C. next week. We need to work out what our schedule might be. I might not be able to do one at our normal time. We need to figure that out.
So inform the center of that. The center being Blogging Head Central, the suits there. Follow us at DMZ Show, and Bill Scherr, good talking to you.
You too. Take care.
Thanks.
Thanks for listening to Blogging Heads TV. You can help support this content by remembering to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. You can subscribe to all Blogging Heads episodes or to a specific program by going to our subscribe page at bloggingheads.tv/subscribe. There you can sign up for podcast downloads via iTunes or Stitcher, or you can subscribe to our email and we'll send you an alert every time we post a new episode.